Hey everyone, this is Dr. Marie McNeely welcoming you to episode 244 of People Behind the Science. Our brilliant guest today is Dr. Cassandra Extivore. I appreciate you joining me today, and I'll let you know we have a fantastic show on the way. And now listeners, if you're like me and you have a mile-long books to read list, I think it's time to go ahead and add a few more to that list. Our guests have been giving us so many awesome recommendations, and we're keeping a list on our website at www.peoplebehindthescience.com/resources, so go check it out if you're on the lookout for your next book. And now, listeners, on with the show here. Cassandra has some excellent insights to share with us, so get ready to meet another one of our exceptional people behind the science.
Every day, discoveries are made that will change our understanding of the world around us. Dr. Marie McNeely is here to bring you the brilliant minds who are making these discoveries so they can share their incredible stories and take you on an amazing journey. Welcome to People Behind the Science.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of People Behind the Science. Today, I am excited to introduce you all to Dr. Cassandra Extivore. So thank you so much for joining us today, Cassandra. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, we are delighted to have you on our program, and I'm excited to introduce you to our listeners. So listeners, a little info about Cassandra. She is a professor of organismic and evolutionary biology and professor of molecular and cellular biology at Harvard University. She received her PhD from the Severo Ochoa Center for Molecular Biology at the Autonomous University of Madrid. Cassandra then conducted postdoctoral research at the Institute for Molecular Biology and Biotechnology in Crete, Greece, as well as at the University of Cambridge. Afterward, she worked as a research associate in the Department of Zoology at Cambridge before joining the faculty where she is now at Harvard. Now, Cassandra is here with us today to tell us about her journey through life and science. So, Cassandra, today we want to get to know you, both as a scientist and also as a person. So can you start by telling us what you like to do when you're not doing science?
Sure. I think what I do most of the time when I'm not doing science has something to do with music. I'm either listening to music or performing music. I sing or I'm dancing. And so I don't dance professionally, but I do sing professionally. And so that takes up most of my non-science time. And then other than that, I really like entertaining, so I like having parties, and I like cooking, so I like to cook and have people come over and eat the food and spend time with friends and family.
Wonderful. So what kind of singing do you do? Is it opera or?
It's classical, yeah. Okay. So anywhere from medieval to 20th century with the emphasis on Baroque music.
Very, very cool. And I think a lot of people perceive scientists as being very serious and maybe even one-dimensional. So it's great to talk to people who have all these different interests. Can you tell us next, though, Cassandra, about your science? Can you tell us how you describe what you do to someone who might not be familiar with science?
Sure. So what we study is called the evolution of development. And so by evolution, we mean the gradual changes in the genetic material in the DNA over really long periods of time. And by development, what we mean is embryonic development. So all organisms that are multicellular, like animals and plants, start life as just a single cell. And usually that single cell is a fertilized egg. That cell has to divide, and there's two cells, and then they divide, and then there are four cells. And they keep doing this for a while, and then there's millions of cells. Now, all these cells have the same genetic information. They all have the exact same DNA that's exactly the same as that first original fertilized egg cell, but they're all doing different things with this information. If you're a turtle, for example, some of the cells need to make a shell, some of them need to make the claws, some of them need to make the eyes. And so the problem of development, those of us who think that developmental biology is the most interesting thing in the world, we think that it's super interesting to figure out how the different cells decide to do different things with that same DNA material that they have. It's as if we all have the same set of encyclopedias, but you're only reading volume A and I'm only reading volume Q. And that's a really hard problem to figure out, and it's really interesting. So we're interested in how genes tell cells during development what they should be doing, how cells know which genes they should pay attention to and which genes they should ignore. And we're interested in the evolutionary origin of these genes. Where did the genes tell cells to do things during development? Where did they come from in evolution? How did they evolve? So those are the questions that we study in my lab.
Very interesting. Well, I look forward to chatting more in detail about these projects and some of the work that you're doing now. Now, can you share what motivates you? I think scientists have so much to do in a day. It's often difficult to get it all done. So it's nice to have these motivational forces or sayings or things kind of going in the back of your mind to keep you moving. So can you share one of yours with us today?
What motivates me the most is something that is complicated, that has a lot of different parts, and trying to sort it out in a really efficient way. And I would say that that's something that's motivational to me, both in science and in life generally. It's why I enjoy doing music in the way that I do. I like doing music with a lot of different people, music that's complex, and sorting it out into its different parts and figuring out how to make it come together. And I see many problems in biology, like development, as complex problems that need to be sorted out efficiently and put into parts logically and then sewn together. And even the enterprise of science, I have to say, I enjoy the sort of job of being a scientist as much as I enjoy the science itself, because the science obviously is lots of complex parts, cells and genes and things like that. But being a scientist is motivating students, motivating teachers, talking to people, traveling, writing, reading, thinking. I get to do a billion different things in the span of one day, and that really suits my personality because I get bored very quickly. So I'm really motivated by complexity and by trying to reduce complexity in efficient ways and then moving on to new problems. I have to say I'm also strongly motivated by overcoming obstacles that other people think I can't get over. And so I've definitely had a lot of experiences in my life where I've been held to very low expectations, and it's motivating to me to show people that they're wrong about what they assume about me. And so my favorite quote is a line from one of Bob Marley's maybe lesser known songs called Babylon System. And it's, "We refuse to be what you wanted us to be. We are what we are. That's the way we're going to be." So many of the choices that I've made in my life have been motivated by deciding that I was going to try to do something that someone either implied or directly told me they thought I couldn't do. So those are things that motivate me.
Certainly. Well, I love this story that goes behind this motivational quote or saying, and fantastic mindset to bring to science. So can you take us back now and tell us a little bit about your journey, and maybe start by telling us, Cassandra, about some of the people who you've looked up to along the way. Can you tell us about your role models?
I think scientifically, intellectually, and also in terms of the practice of science, definitely my strongest role model was my graduate thesis advisor, who was Antonio García Bellido. I went to Spain to work with him as a PhD student because reading his papers, it was clear that he, like many other people, was thinking about this problem of development and how cells made decisions about what they should be doing based on the genes that they had and the information that was available to them. But he seemed, from his papers, to be thinking about these cellular behaviors in ways that were totally unlike the mainstream biology at the time. And I wanted to learn how he thought, and I wanted to learn how to think like him. And so that's why I moved to Madrid to study with him. And he's definitely been the single most important intellectual motivator and role model for me as a scientist. The two things that characterize Antonio and really set him apart in my mind from other scientists are his thoroughness and the height of the bar that he sets for a level of understanding. He has a very high bar to consider that he understands something that's truly new about what a cell does. And the second thing that sets Antonio apart and has him as a great role model for me is that he doesn't care what other people think of his ideas. Some of the most revolutionary ideas that he contributed to science in the 70s were actively and publicly rejected by many famous scientists at that time, partly because they thought it was crazy. Nobody had thought that cells could do the things he was suggesting they could do. And frankly, partly because he came from a part of the world, from Spain, that was not famous for producing scientists in that tradition. And Antonio doesn't care. He cares about making the best possible scientific case for what he believes could be true and gathering the best possible evidence. And if other people don't agree with it, it's not important to him. It's important to him to keep going to be true to his vision. And that's something that I carry with me as well. So I would say he's my strongest scientific role model.
Well, I really like some of these traits that you're pointing out that you admire in scientists. And I think this fearlessness, this sort of not being deterred by the doubters, is really important in science, because a lot of these revolutionary ideas throughout history in science have initially sort of been mocked and belittled and things like that. So definitely a great trait to have as a scientist. And now, you mentioned you did your PhD in Spain, but I know you're originally from Toronto. So was it difficult to make that transition then to be studying internationally?
You know, that's been one of the things that I've enjoyed the most about being a scientist. And it wasn't something that I realized that scientists could do so much is travel. No, I didn't find it difficult. I mean, that doesn't mean that there weren't days that were challenging, but to be honest, I just didn't think very much about it. I was, you know, 21 or something. I finished my undergraduate degree in Toronto, and I thought, I want to study it in a different country. I knew that I wanted to stay in school because it was easier for me than getting a job. I understood what being in school was, and I was good at that. And getting a job was sort of mysterious to me at that stage, since I'd always been a student. It was also attractive because by that time I had learned that being in graduate school in experimental sciences meant that you got a stipend, which for me would mean that I wouldn't have to work at the same time as I was going to school, which is something I had done since I was 12 years old. So being a graduate student was also attractive from a financial point of view. I knew that I wanted to leave Canada and have the experience of living in another language because I wanted to become bilingual in another language to see if it would change the way that I thought about things. And I didn't really care what language it was, but I just wanted to have that experience. And I was also fascinated by developmental biology. And so I found Antonio's work, which we had studied in class, and I got in touch with him. And that was kind of all the thought that I gave to it. I didn't know anyone in Europe. I'd never been to Europe before. And I was very naive in a way, but I really enjoyed it. It's definitely been an extremely formative part of my career, the fact that I've trained and worked in many different countries. Because what that enables you to do is to, just as when you move away from the environment that you were raised in, you can more easily determine who you are as a person as opposed to who your environment has made you to be. In the same way, you can do this as a scientist. You can realize how much of your intellectual influences were just the understood cultural scientific norms of the place that you were first trained, as opposed to how many of these ideas are genuinely coming from you and how many of them are independent of the culture where they're first performed. So traveling internationally as a scientist has been very important for me, and I strongly recommend it.
Absolutely. Well, I think there are so many great opportunities for scientists to travel and to train internationally. Now, have you maintained this fluency in Spanish?
Yes, I'm still fluent in Spanish. I wrote my thesis in Spanish, and I defended it in Spanish. That was part of my goal, was to become bilingual. And I still speak Spanish almost every day. Spanish speakers are a big proportion of the world population, and they travel a lot. And so almost everywhere I go, there are people who I still speak with, and of course my friends in Spain who I keep in touch with.
So do you, and this is a question that I always wonder in terms of people who are multilingual, do you tend to think in English or Spanish?
In high-stress situations, if I'm extremely angry or extremely excited, I will tend to think in Spanish.
Really?
Yes, and I think that's because moving to Spain on my own at 21 or 22, I grew up there as an adult independently for the first time. And so in some senses, I was able to express myself completely freely for the first time. And that was the language that I happened to be in. It's also the case that Spanish can be a much more expressive language. And I would say that generally Spanish culture is much more emotionally expressive than the Canadian culture that I grew up with. And so I think all of those things contribute to that fact.
Well, very, very interesting. I'm a neuroscientist, so I'm dissecting this whole situation here. But this is fantastic, Cassandra. So we've talked about a small window of your career, of your training. Can you take us all the way back to the beginning now and tell us how your journey in science began? What really sparked your interest in the very beginning?
Sure. I came to science very late. I was not interested in nature or science or anything like that as a child. I was interested in music and performance. So my goal was to be a performer, to be a musician probably. Because I showed an interest and aptitude for the arts very early, I was always actively encouraged to pursue these things by family and teachers especially. And because I didn't show any particular interest or aptitude for sciences or math, I wasn't encouraged to explore those further. And so what I'm saying is that because I was great at music and languages, it didn't seem to bother anybody that I was sort of mediocre at other things. And it didn't occur to anybody, and it didn't occur to me either, to say, well, how is it that you can be so talented at this thing, but you're not excelling at this other thing? Maybe there's something about it. And so I didn't really pay any attention to the sciences until I was about 16 or 17, so really almost finished secondary school. And at that stage, because my best friend at the time said that he was going to be a psychologist, and then that got me thinking about people's behavior, and I had always thought that human behavior was fascinating in a terrible way, because humans have inherently terrible behavior, I believe, towards each other especially. I thought it would be really interesting to figure out how the brain made people behave in different ways. And I independently, without consulting with any guidance counselor or anything, got it into my head that in order to understand how the human brain worked, I should train to be a neurosurgeon, because surely they must learn and understand as much as we know about how the brain works and direct human behavior because they get to cut into it. And so that led me to think, well, then I need to be a pre-med in undergrad. And I was almost at the end of high school and I hadn't taken any of the advanced science credits. So I convinced the school to let me teach myself the science over the summer and take the exam so that I could get into the advanced course. So that final year of high school in Canada, you have to take a certain number of these advanced credits in different subjects in order to get into university. At least that's how it was when I was there. So I taught myself the required mid-level chemistry, physics, biology over the summer before my final year of high school so that I could take the advanced credits in the final year of high school and then get into biology, life science undergrad. So I started at University of Toronto then as a life science undergraduate, and my plan was to fast track into medical school after just 2 years of undergrad, which was possible in Canada at the time. And that was also the plan of the other 2,000 kids in my class at the University of Toronto. And so the atmosphere was toxic to me. I was never interested in practicing medicine. I just wanted to learn about the brain. The concept of neuroscience as an academic science didn't occur to me. I didn't know about that. I just thought medicine. But clearly the other kids in my class weren't interested in the content. They just wanted to make sure they got the highest grade. And so I decided I wouldn't do the fast track to medical school. I would just do the normal track. I would just do a 4-year degree. And then I would go to medical school, or I would see how I felt after that 4-year degree. And that meant I had to choose a major subject. And I only chose genetics because a close friend of mine in a choir that I sang in was in the genetics program. She said it was okay. So I picked that box pretty randomly. And I almost dropped out of the genetics program I was in the first few years to transfer into the math program because I found the first 2 years of undergraduate biology really boring. I found the molecular and chemical aspects of biology totally memorization-based. I didn't see the logic behind learning all the names of these proteins and pieces of molecules. I found the evolutionary and ecology aspects of biology qualitative and arbitrary. I didn't see where the quantitative reasoning was. So I was really turned off by biology for the first 2 years. And only when I took biochemistry in my third year towards the end of undergraduate did I become interested in biology, because biochemistry to me provided a logical language that made sense. And it was like a game. Biochemistry were the rules that connected these little pieces of the puzzle, which were the names of all those things I was supposed to have memorized in the second year. And so that to me was logic-based and fact-based and quantitative. That seemed more like science. So then I stayed in my molecular genetics program. And by the end of it, I had become interested in development because I realized that to learn more about these types of things, I would need to go to graduate school. And I knew that graduate students were not students like I was a student. They didn't take classes. I didn't really have a good sense of what they did. My parents did not go to college, and I don't have academic friends or family. Well, I do now, but I didn't then. So I didn't really have an idea of what this graduate school business was. So I knew that I needed to get experience in a lab so that I could get a sense of what was going to be in store for me. And the lab that I ended up getting experience in for the first time as an undergraduate was a developmental genetics lab run by Joe Calotti at University of Toronto. He studied axon guidance in C. elegans, and my job was to map a series of mutants that they had generated from a screen. So I found that I loved genetics. I loved development. I was convinced that this was the most fascinating problem in biology and that genetics was the way to understand the problem. And so that's what led me to go to graduate school. And then after I finished graduate school, I decided that I was not interested anymore in considering development only from the point of view of one organism. I need to understand how the development of one organism related to the development of another organism. And so the context that I needed was evolution. And so that's why I chose to do postdoctoral work in labs that focused on comparative development and evolutionary development. And again, I just went to do a postdoc to learn a little bit more about comparative work. I had never thought about being an academic or a professional scientist or a professor or anything. But I guess it was two things that happened. In the year that I became a postdoc at Cambridge, there was a job advertised at the University of Toronto, an assistant professorship. And I thought, oh, well, I'd never thought about being a faculty member, but I could go back to Toronto, which I loved. So I applied for the job. You know, even though I wasn't offered the job, it was a great experience because of two things. One, I learned that it was extremely easy to apply for a faculty job. It was much easier than applying for fellowships or degrees because you just had to write a couple of pages of your research statement, and you had to have a CV that was up to date and have a few references ready to speak on your behalf. And so that seemed to me very easy. So I thought, I have nothing to lose by applying for this job. And I had a fellowship in the UK, so it was fine if I didn't get it. And I got an interview for the job. And so that also taught me that the worst case scenario, even if you get invited for an interview but you don't get the job, it's a great way to meet new people and get feedback on your work and learn about their work.
Yeah.
So then, you know, I had my funding in the UK. And then a year after that Toronto experience, this job was advertised at Harvard. And I'd never wanted to live in the US. And I still wasn't convinced that I really wanted to run my own group. But I was really obsessed with experimental embryology of the late 19th century at that time, a lot of which was performed by people who were working in the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology at that time. And that's the museum that is associated with organismic and evolutionary biology, which is now my department. And so I thought, well, I wouldn't have to live in the U.S. forever. I hear nobody gets tenure at Harvard anyway, so it's not like I would be there for a long time. And it's really easy to apply for faculty jobs, as I had learned a couple of years earlier. And I also convinced I obviously wouldn't get the job, so I thought, why not? But then I did get the job. And so I was able to defer for a couple of years because I still had several years worth of funding left in the UK. I didn't want to lose that. And so I accepted the position at Harvard, but I arranged to come 2 years after. And so I was able to stay in the UK, finish most of what I wanted to do there, and then move over.
Well, Cassandra, you touched on so many amazing points that I'm sure resonated with a lot of our listeners when you're describing your journey. I think a lot of us were in that boat where we had a sense that we were interested in science but didn't really know what to make of it in terms of careers. And at some point, you get fascinated with research. I really, really like your approach to applying for jobs. And I think that's something where a lot of people are feeling down about the scientific job market these days. And I think you're absolutely right in that you need to just put your applications out there. It's not that much work necessarily to apply to these jobs. Worst case scenario, they say no. You're not going to get the job 100% of the time if you don't apply. So absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting to hear about your experiences and your journey, Cassandra. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now? What is one of these projects that you're doing that you are so excited about?
One of the projects in the lab that I'm really excited about at the moment, what our plan was to try to understand the evolution of genes that tell cells that should become reproductive cells, so that should make eggs and sperm. We call those germ cells. We were interested in the evolution of genes that tell germ cells that they should become germ cells. And so we were studying a bunch of these genes, and we found something that was really surprising to us, and that was this. There's a gene that in the fruit fly is called Oscar, and this Oscar gene in fruit flies is absolutely indispensable for making germ cells. If the animal doesn't have a working copy of this gene, it's sterile because it can't make any germ cells. All the rest of the body is fine, but there's just no germ cells. The Oscar had been a mystery to developmental biologists since it was discovered over 30 years ago, because even though we understood a lot about what its genetic functions were in the fruit fly, there were two major areas that were totally mysterious to us. One was, why is Oscar only found in a few insects? Because most animals share most of their genes. Really, a majority of their genes are the same as ours. But this Oscar gene seems unique. People could only find it in a few flies and a few mosquitoes. And a colleague of mine, Jeremy Lynch, found it in a wasp a few years ago. But that was it. So it was kind of weird that this gene was so important in flies, but it couldn't be found anywhere else outside of these few insects. The other thing that was really mysterious about Oscar was, how does Oscar really work at the molecular level? So most genes that we work on, what they are like instructions to make proteins, and these proteins have specific jobs inside the cell. And usually, from the sequence of a gene, you can tell what kind of protein that is. But from Oscar's sequence, nobody could guess what it did inside the cell to turn that cell into a germ cell. So two big mysteries. Where does it come from and what does it actually do? So it turns out that we unexpectedly have been able to begin to make some contributions to both of these questions, not by studying fruit flies, but by studying a whole bunch of other insects that people don't usually study. And so we've been studying for a few years a cricket called Gryllus spermaculatus, and we found a copy of Oscar in this cricket. So that was really exciting because this was the most basally branching insect. And when I say basally branching, what I mean is we think that it is closer to the last common ancestor of all insects than fruit flies are. So it might tell us something more profound about the evolutionary origin of the genes that it has and the ways that its cells behave compared to Drosophila, which is much further derived from a last common insect ancestor. So by studying this basally branching cricket, we were able to learn a number of things that were quite surprising to us about Oscar. The first was that Oscar is a lot older than we thought, because it was thought previously that Oscar had first emerged in evolution fairly recently, so about 300 million years ago, in a particular group of derived insects that included fruit flies. But since we found it in this cricket, and the cricket branches basally in insects, this means that it must be at least 50 million years older than that. So that told us that Oscar was a lot older than we thought. We also have found Oscar since then in many, many other insects. In almost every single order, those are the major types of insects, we've been able to find Oscar genes. So this tells us that Oscar really is widespread in insects, much more so than we have previously realized. we still haven't been able to find Oscar in anything that's not an insect, though. So that is telling us more and more that Oscar is probably an insect-specific gene. And so in terms of what Oscar actually does at the molecular level, because we have so many more sequences of Oscars than we used to have maybe 10, and now we have almost 40. By comparing so many different sequences, this can actually start to give us some new clues. We can now start to make better guesses just from the sequence as to what Oscar might be doing at a biochemical level. And so we have people in the lab who are looking at the biochemical function of Oscar, both the fly version of Oscar and the cricket version of Oscar. And it turns out that biochemically, they actually behave very differently. And when we do functional tests in the cricket to see what does the cricket use Oscar for, it turns out that unlike fruit flies, where Oscar is absolutely required to make sure you have germ cells, in crickets, Oscar is not needed for germ cells at all. It's totally dispensable.
Huh.
Yes. But in the cricket, it's required for the nervous system. It's required for the embryonic nervous system to set itself up properly, and it's required for the adult system, the adult nervous system, to work properly. And so now, in a totally unexpected branch of our research, by looking at the evolution of reproductive systems, now we're looking at neuroscience, we're looking at biochemistry, we're looking at the evolution of novel genes, brand new genes that didn't used to be there, and now they suddenly turn up in the genome. So this is really exciting to me because these were areas of research I could never have guessed that we would go in. They're extremely interesting, and they might tell us something about a longstanding mystery, which is how new genes come into existence and how new genes that come into existence can change developmental programs to create whole new ways of telling cells what to do.
Wow, Cassandra, in describing this project, you have really woven this just intriguing evolutionary and developmental story. I feel like I was just pulling off the edge of my seat here. That is phenomenal. So do you have future directions? Are there anticipations that you'll find a similar sort of gene in other animals outside of insects? Or is there a reason why you might not be seeing them in other animals?
Well, we definitely know that there are similar sorts of genes in other animals. And when I say similar sorts of genes, I mean genes that in a kind of a qualitative way, like Oscar, can also tell cells that they should be germ cells. And so genes like this are known from, for example, the nematode C. elegans. And Susan Strom and Geraldine Sadu and others have done a lot of work to tell us how these genes work. And what's interesting, at least in the worm case, if C. elegans is a little worm, these worm genes that act in a similar way to Oscar, but based on their sequence, we can tell they're not related to Oscar at all. So they're not Oscar's relatives or cousins at all. They're just totally separate evolutionary inventions. And yet they can have similar cell fate determination roles in these cells. And what's interesting about these worm genes is that, like Oscar, they also appear to have sprung up fairly recently in evolution, just in that lineage of worms. You can't find those genes in other organisms. Similar to Oscar, when you look at their amino acid sequence, you can't easily predict what is this protein supposed to do. So you need a lot of sequence data and a lot of biochemistry to start to get at that question. You can't just rely on the sequence. So it's really fascinating, not only that in different branches of the evolutionary tree of animals, different branches have invented different genes that have the property of being able to tell a cell that needs to become a germ cell. If evolution has invented these genes that have a different sequence every time they're invented, and yet their function somehow is similar. So they've got different sequences, they're making different types of proteins, but these proteins are able to get the same type of job done in these cells. And so that's a really fascinating example of something that we call convergent evolution. And convergent evolution is the independent evolution of phenotypes or traits that look similar, but these traits don't look similar because they have a last common ancestor, because their ancestor all had that same trait. They've just independently arisen, completely independently of each other. And so here what we have, we think, is the convergent evolution of a type of developmental mechanism that in each instance of its evolution has relied on a different gene sequence being created.
Well, very, very interesting work, Cassandra. Great to get a window into what you're working on in your lab. What are some of these exciting questions that your group is tackling? And I think we've talked about a lot of the great aspects about careers in science and about your journey in particular. And we haven't yet touched on some of the struggles. And I know every scientist goes through challenging times and has failures, but I think not a lot of scientists talk about what it's like to go through these times and how they got through these times. So can you share with us today one of these major failures that you've experienced or just a difficult time that you went through and how you got through it?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, let me see. When I was a PhD student, I went to Antonio's lab in Madrid and we discussed a number of project options and I picked one that I thought was most interesting and he thought that was the most interesting. And so we sort of went on that and nothing worked for 2.5 years. Basically, I had a specific technical challenge, which was I had to create flies that had germ cells that had different genotypes. So within the same fly embryo to make sure that the embryonic germ cells were not all genetically identical. And there are a number of different tricks in fly genetics for allowing you to create genetic heterogeneity within one animal. But for various technical reasons, these tricks are really hard to implement in germ cells. They work really well in cells that aren't germ cells, but in germ cells, they're especially hard to do in embryonic germ cells. And so I tried, I think, about 8 different methods over the course of 2.5 years.
Oh, wow.
And each method takes several months of investment and sort of multitasking and overlapping methods. And I got down to the last method that I could think of, the last method that Antonio could think of that might possibly work. And for, again, a lot of technical reasons, it was kind of an undesirable method because it had the potential to introduce a lot of artifacts into the system, which meant I was going to have to do a lot more control experiments. So it was a really a last-ditch attempt. And by this time, I was 2.5 years into my PhD. My PhD fellowship was only 4 years, and that's typically how long a PhD takes in the system that I was in. And so I knew that if this didn't work, I was going to be in trouble and I was going to have to think of another project to do. And so I decided to have a meeting with my advisor and to just broach this subject to him. And I think, you know, as often happened at the beginning of these meetings, Antonio was very busy and he kind of wasn't really paying super attention to what I was saying until I said, so I'm going to try this last method that we've discussed. And if it doesn't work, then I'm going to start thinking about what project I can do. And then he sort of stopped looking out the window and
tuned back in.
What did you say? Yeah. And I said, well, you know, I only have less than 2 years left and I am not going to spend all my time working on a project that doesn't work because, you know, I came here to be able to carry something to fruition. And he said, no. He said, you cannot leave this project. You must do this project. He banged on the desk. He's a very emphatic man.
Oh, wow.
You have to do this project. This is the only project that you can be doing. And
Pressure's on. By
that time, I'd been in the lab for 2.5 years. And I'd learned that when Antonio gets into these moods, it's not worth your time to argue with him. You need to go away and find a different strategy to deal with it. And so I very quietly, mentally began preparing for the possibility that he would tell me that I had to leave the lab. He was extremely strong-minded, I'll just put it that way. And so if he thought that something needed to be a certain way, there was no convincing him that it could be otherwise. And so I knew that if Antonio was very clearly not in favor of me doing anything else, he was not going to support me in the lab unless I did that project. At least that was my thinking at the time. Now that I'm older and I know Antonio much better and I sympathize with what it's like to be a PI, I think it's unlikely that he would have kicked me out of the lab if I didn't want to do that project. But, you know, you can't know that at the time. I had only the experience that I had. And from my student perspective, you know, it was, you know, go big or go home. And so I devised a work schedule for myself that I said, what I have to do is make sure exhaustively and systematically that this system either works or does not work, because if it doesn't work, I have to leave no stone unturned to make sure that it's definitive that the system can't work. And Antonio had told me that he was going to a conference at a certain time a few months down the road and wanted to talk about the work that I was doing, so I needed to have something for him to say. So I devised a work schedule for myself that had me working from 5 a.m. until 2 a.m. every day for 3 months.
Oh my gosh, how did you do it?
You know, it wasn't the healthiest time in my life. I wasn't sleeping very much and I was eating a lot of trash, but it worked. I walked through all the systematic possibilities of whether or not the system could work, and it turned out that the system did work. And I got preliminary data that were very exciting, and I made slides so Antonio could go to his conference and talk about it.
And you got a PhD. Life is good.
I did. So, you know, maybe that's not a great example. I wouldn't call it a success, but it was a failure rather. But it was certainly a time when I felt my goal that I had set out for myself might not be achievable, and I might be facing loss of something that I had invested a lot into, and what was I going to do about that? And so for me, the thing to do, which is my attitude, I guess, when I'm facing challenges in general, is to get in front of that possible failure, not to wait to see if you fail, but to set up plan B and plan C and plan D. So I set up a lot of contingency plans, both practically and psychologically, so that I am not shocked or unduly held back by mental distress when the failure point comes. I'm already prepared for plan B. for example, when I submit a paper in the lab, I'm discussing with whoever's work it is in the lab, okay, where do you think you'd like to send this? Who do you want to read this work? We say, okay, now let's already prepare plan B. Of course, in an ideal world, you know, your first choice journal will accept your work and then we'll be able to publish it. But that might not happen for lots of reasons that have nothing to do with your science. So let's already prepare mentally. And for every paper we send, doesn't matter what journal we're sending it to, we have a plan B contingency. And that I find helps me and helps people in my lab psychologically to focus on the greater goal, which is I want the community to read my work, and not to focus on a minor, less important goal, which is I want this work to be published in Journal X.
Definitely.
And so in the PhD case, you know, my goal was I want to carry a genetics project through to fruition and communicate it and get a degree before I run out of money. That's the greater goal. And so how am I going to achieve that if my first choice manner of getting there doesn't work? What's my next plan? And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because science is 99% failure, especially if it's experimental science.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Cassandra. And I think you have just such a phenomenal systematic approach to science. And I think that is really key to success and even getting through these failures and tough times, is just being systematic about it, making sure you're leaving no stone unturned, as you put it, and really just getting through it. And sometimes that's what it takes, especially I think in your PhD days when you have a deadline. You know, you only have X years of funding, or the lab is going to move at a certain point, or, you know, there's certain things that necessitate that you get things done quickly. So phenomenal story that you shared with us, really getting through this almost do or die situation in your PhD work. But we don't just want to talk about the tough times. So can you tell us about one of these moments in your career or your life where you had a major success or even just a small victory along the way that really meant a lot to you?
One thing that I consider a success that's happened in the last couple of years that I'm really pleased about is about 3 years ago, together with a guy named Alan Rodrigo, who's the director of NESCENT, which is an evolutionary biology synthesis center in Durham, we organized a workshop for the Igbo-Igbo community in North America. And the goal of this workshop was not to talk to each other about the work that we were doing, because we all already know what everybody's doing, but to come together and talk about the field of evolutionary developmental biology, particularly in the Americas, what its current status is, what it's been able to achieve, what it has not been able to achieve, and what it would like to achieve in the future, and what are the barriers holding us back from doing this. And so we came together, about 35 of us, and met for about 3 days there. And what I was really pleased about at this workshop was that these types of workshops can run the risk of being a massive waste of time and money, because
right.
Scientists are very hard to control. They love to talk about themselves. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much their favorite topic. They love to talk about their own work. And their second most favorite topic is talking about how other people's work is not very good, or what's wrong with the system, right?
Of course. You have to defend your work. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And there's a lot more talk than there is walk in general. So I was a little bit worried that this would just be a hot air session. And what I was really going for was, okay, if you think that there's something wrong with the way that our field is conducting itself professionally, how specifically can we make that difference? And what specifically are you personally going to do to help make that difference? So what I was really pleased at was that many, many people who were at this conference really stepped up to the plate and said, here is my concrete suggestion, and here's what I'm actually going to do to try to make this suggestion a reality. Who's with me? And lots of people joined up. And so as a result, a number of concrete things have happened. One is that a sort of a large multi-authored perspective on the past successes and future directions and future promise of the field has been written and is going to come out soon in the journal called Evolution and Development. And another thing that's happened is that a brand new professional society has been born, which is the Pan-American Society for Evolutionary Developmental Biology. There was no such professional society in existence in anywhere in the world except for Europe, where the European Society for Evolutionary Developmental Biology was founded over 10 years ago. But the Americas community has yet to come together in this way. And so we've formed a new professional society that is going to organize its inaugural meeting in Berkeley, California, in August of 2015. And so that is a new, concrete, and I believe positive and hopefully long-lasting new element in our field that I've helped bring into being. And of course, you know, obviously I didn't do it alone, but I was really pleased to be able to organize a workshop that was effective enough that it could lead to some concrete new actions that will hopefully help the field get better in the future.
Wow. Well, Cassandra, congratulations on being a part of that series of successes. I mean, I think anytime you get 35 people together, getting them to agree on anything, much less fighting that diffusion of responsibility problem that happens in big groups, I think is just phenomenal. So congratulations again. And I think it's interesting to talk about these different kinds of successes in science. I mean, a lot of people do point to grants and papers and things like that, but this was really a success for moving the whole field forward. So that is wonderful.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And so we've talked about some of the things that you like to do when you're not at work. And I think one thing that a lot of scientists point to that they do enjoy doing, and perhaps they don't get to do enough of, is to read for fun. So I always ask guests on our program to give us a book recommendation. So Cassandra, I'm going to ask you today, can you tell us about a book that you've read and really enjoyed that you think myself and our listeners should check out?
Sure. I like to read a lot of things. I like to read a lot of science fiction, especially sort of hardcore space opera these days. I like to read a lot of nonfiction. And so I think one of the few books that I would reread is a book by Derek Bell, who's an American lawyer, and it's called Faces at the Bottom of the Well. And the subtitle of the book is The Permanence of Racism. This is a series of fictional stories that Derek Bell has written to pose questions as to what the likely outcomes would be of certain circumstances were they to occur. The outcomes both in terms of human behavior, human political decisions, and legal precedent for such decisions. And he does this in a way, it could be a textbook for law students, saying if situation X were to occur in the future, based on the legal precedent for similar circumstances, what would the right thing be to do? What would the legal thing be to do? What would the ethical thing be to do? What would the political decisions be that were made? And those four things obviously might not coincide.
Right.
So, you know, for example, in one of the stories, aliens come to Earth. We've been waiting for contact from extraterrestrials for a long time. So this, you know, speaks to my love of science fiction as well. So the aliens finally come down. They make contact. It's fantastic. They want to meet our ambassadors and so on. Now, they're not super friendly. They say that their plan is to take over the Earth and they'll destroy it if they meet any resistance. However, there is one condition that they would accept. And if we agree to this as humans, and really they're only negotiating with the government of the United States, so it is a very U.S.-centric point of view. But if the U.S. government will agree to this one condition, then they will leave the Earth alone. And that one condition is that all of the black people from the U.S. should be sold into slavery to these aliens.
Oh, wow.
Right. And so then the task of the reader is to think, well, what should be done in this case? What would be done in this case? And of course, we can't divorce those things from our past, from the legal past and the political past and the social and cultural past of the country and the race, obviously, the human race. And so to me, this is one of my favorite books because so each story presents a huge challenge along these lines. And this is one of my favorite books because it's fiction that is, in a way, sort of a possible future revision. So it's imagining things that could happen in the future, and it's doing so in a way that is informed by what's actually happened in the past. And so I think for me, it embodies a kind of a greater message, which is that to think realistically about what's going to happen in the future and what you would like the future to be like, you can't just rely on fantastical dreams of utopia where everybody just gets along and everything is fantastic all the time. Because humans have no consistent historical trajectory of creating a reality that is like that. In order to think realistically about the future, you have to think in a hard and realistic way about what humans have done in the past and what they have been able to do and what they have been unable to do in the past. And only by grounding yourself properly in what has actually happened and by informing yourself, can you make realistic goals and projections for the future. So that book for me is not only extremely relevant to what we happen to be living in at the moment, contemporary race relations in America is a total mess, but in a broader sense, it has what for me is a very powerful message, which is an ancient message also in many cultures, which is that you cannot go forward without knowing your past.
Absolutely. Well, Cassandra, this sounds like a fascinating read, and I think maybe a different way of thinking for a lot of scientists who spend their day thinking more analytically rather than really contemplating these ethical and philosophical implications that you're describing here. So fantastic recommendation. We'll put that out on our website for our listeners to check out. And I know throughout this interview, we've hinted a lot of times and kind of discussed some of the opportunities that you've had to travel throughout your career for training and for different opportunities as they've come up. So can you think back now and tell us about your favorite travel opportunity that you've experienced? Where were you and why was it so memorable?
I think my favorite place that I've lived and done science was in Crete, in Greece, when I was a postdoc there. And I think that was my favorite because Greece is a beautiful country with a fascinating history. My name is Greek, even though my family is not Greek. So I've always been interested in that. And it was a very interesting experience to travel as a non-Greek person with a Greek name in, you know, the country of the origin of that name, because it's an immediate conversation starter with everyone. And it invites them to tell you about their history, which to me is the most interesting thing about people and their cultures. And so I was able to learn a lot about Greek culture and Greek history while I was there, which is fascinating and beautiful in many ways. The landscape of Crete is very beautiful in particular. All of Greece is beautiful. The beauty of the scenery and the culture and the food, but also the fact that the institute was doing very high quality science, but it was relatively isolated and didn't have a huge amount of financial resources. And so what that meant was that people couldn't just decide on the fly to do an experiment that would cost many thousands of dollars just to see if it would work. They had to put a lot more time and thought into deciding what they would do and which reagents they would use, because reagents were expensive and they would take a long time to arrive also in the institute. And what this did was it made the science proceed at a slightly slower pace than it did, for example, when I was at the University of Cambridge or the University of Toronto, but it didn't make the science worse quality at all. If anything, there was less wasted time and more efficient scientific practice because of those limitations. And so that was a really important thing for me to learn. And I would say I learned the same thing when I was in Argentina briefly between my undergraduate and my graduate degree. I worked in a lab there. And similarly, the relative isolation from Northern Europe and from North America and the relative financial constraints that we existed actually helped people do better quality science more of the time, because they needed to think more carefully about what they were going to do before it was done. And so those were really formative experiences for me scientifically.
Well, thank you for sharing these stories. And I think that's something where a lot of people, our listeners out there, might agree that when you're traveling, you get these opportunities to see a different culture. And it often makes you reflect on how things have been conducted where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true.
Wonderful to hear about some of your travel opportunities. And sounds like you've had some incredible experiences in Greece. Now, we talked a little bit about some of these people who you've encountered over the years as a scientist. And I think each lab group kind of develops its own personality. And we love to highlight the human side of science on our show. So we like to talk about scientists having fun at work. And I think this happens in a lot of different ways. Oftentimes, there are quirky traditions that spring up in different laboratories. Or you can just look back and think about some funny or fun memories that you shared with your colleagues. So can you tell us about one of these experiences or traditions today, Cassandra?
Sure. I mean, one really fun memory that happened that still makes me laugh when I think about it was when I was a postdoc in England. And this was fun and funny, both because there were a lot of humorous elements and there was a lot of good science happening, but also because it perfectly epitomized the cultural mixture that happened to be in the lab at that time. And so when I was a postdoc at the University of Cambridge, there were a cohort of us who were postdocs all together who were very good friends as well as work colleagues. And so we were from, myself from Canada, but having come via Spain and Greece, from Greece, Italy, Israel, Sweden, Argentina. This was a group of us. And our PI, Michael Aiken, was English. And the lab upstairs from us had gone on a lab retreat, which was not something that our lab had a long tradition of. And not many labs in the department at that time that I was aware of had lab retreat traditions. But the lab upstairs from us, we'd heard, had gone on a lab retreat to Sicily. And we were really jealous. And we wanted to go on a lab retreat somewhere really nice and warm. And so we suggested to Michael, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we went on a lab retreat? It would be really good for the science. Of course, we thought he would like it better if we said we wanted to do work. And so we were all thinking with our Southern and Mediterranean mindsets that we should go to Italy or Greece or Spain.
Definitely.
And Michael said, yeah, of course, none of us had any of the money for this. We were hoping Mike would magically pay for it, right? And so Michael said, well, yes, he thought that a lab retreat would be fantastic. And that wouldn't it be nice to go somewhere in England, like Wales, for example. And we were all really disappointed at this. Because
not exactly Sicily, right?
Yeah. We thought, well, we know that, you know, for many people from England, it's really fun to walk in the rain. But we don't want to do that. And why should we go to Wales? Anyway, we did. That's where we went because, of course, we couldn't make the decision. Michael made the decision. So we went to this house in Wales, and it was the stereotypical Welsh countryside, rolling green hills, a billion sheep, ancient stone castles and farms, and fog everywhere, fog, wet, damp fog. But it was really, really fun, both because we were all basically enjoying, you know, these different cultural and sort of experiential expectations that we had. But we also, of course, really enjoyed all being together, even the 6-hour drive all the way out there through the fog and even the fog and the rain. And Michael was just delighted with the whole place and just loved it. And there was, of course, something beautiful and charming about it. And so I think we enjoyed that. And in the labs that I've been in, I would say that a common element to some of the most enjoyable group experiences that the lab has comes when the lab spends time together outside the lab doing something social that is probably not exactly what the individual lab members, particularly everyone who's not a PI, would choose to do in their own social time. It's probably not what they would choose to do. And they get some kind of enjoyment out of the fact that, you know, what their PI thinks is really fun is not exactly what they think is fun, because it provides them an opportunity to bond with each other in the face of the PI, which is something that every group needs. You know, every group is bound together, not only by cohesion, but by exclusion. So I think that these lab things provide an opportunity to do that, and provide an opportunity, of course, to get to see and to know people outside of the bench context or the office context that you're in the lab. And of course, at the end of the day, most people in most labs that I know of and have experienced really do genuinely like their advisor, or at a minimum, respect them, and they're getting more out of being in the lab than they are having taken away from them. And so they also enjoy that time. And most people that I have worked with, certainly from the case in the labs I've been in, they do have a deep respect and admiration for their advisor, because that's why they're in that lab. And so they do enjoy doing that, even if the PI is doing something that you think is a little bit weird or a little bit old-fashioned or a little bit quirky. You're kind of also enjoying it at the same time, because you get to spend time with them, which is something that you appreciate.
Definitely. Well, I think you brought up a really good point there. I mean, I think a lot of people have, at least on one occasion or another, teased their teacher, their PhD advisor, their mentor in some capacity. But beneath that sort of light teasing and things like that, there's so much respect and admiration and things like that. So I do love this description that you're putting together of your experiences in different laboratories, and definitely this almost family road trip sounding excursion in the English countryside. That sounds amazing. Cassandra, thank you so much for sharing your memories today that sort of show the human side of science and some of the fun things that you've done over the years. And I think one of the things that scientists love to do when they're getting together for different occasions is to talk about these big research questions, maybe in the field or just in general. So can you tell us today if things like funding and staff and technology and feasibility were not an issue? What is one of these questions that you are just dying to know the answer to?
One of the things that I'm really thinking a lot about these days is the evolution of multicellularity. And so by that, I mean, scientists think that all life that's on the planet right now, all cellular life, all life is made of cells, plants, animals, bacteria, fungi, that we all come from a last common ancestor that was also a cell. And that we think that before multicellular life, like plants or whales, evolved on Earth, that initially cellular life was unicellular. Things like bacteria today, for example, are largely unicellular. So one cell divides, and then the two daughter cells don't stick together. They just, each one goes its own way, and they do their own thing, like single cells. But at some stage, more than once in evolution, multicellularity evolved. So that means that one of two things had to happen. Either cells that were already single cells out there in the world had to come together and stick together to form a multicellular aggregate, or once a cell divided, instead of letting it go of its daughter, it would hang on to it. So the cells that divided will all stay stuck together. We humans, for example, develop in a stuck-together way. So we have one single cell that divides and makes two cells, and the two cells stay stuck together. When they divide and make four cells, they all stay stuck together. So it's a pretty big topic these days in the areas of research that I'm familiar with to try to look at the evolution of multicellularity and to ask, how could multicellularity have evolved? And what I mean by how is, what are the mechanisms, the molecular and genetic mechanisms, that could have allowed these things to happen? And so there's a lot of theoretical work around that, and there's some experimental work around that. And the experimental work involves taking unicellular organisms and basically waiting for them to evolve multicellularity in the lab. Now, you might think you have to wait a really long time, but if you start with a unicellular organism whose generation time is really, really fast, like maybe only minutes, then actually you can do that. And it turns out that many, many different people in different labs across the world have been able to do this, to take unicellular organisms and evolve them into multicellular organisms.
Really? That is phenomenal.
Yeah. Now, when I say multicellular organisms, it's not like it's, you know,
a
doing anything.
Anything, right?
It's just a blob. Yeah, it's just a blob of cells. And so then the next great question is, well, you know, we're multicellular, huge blobs of cells, and we can divide as whole multicellular units, right? We can reproduce as multicellular units. And so evolving multicellular reproduction is a much more complicated event that, to my knowledge, has actually only been demonstrated once experimentally in the literature. One of the prevailing ways to think about the evolution of multicellularity is that external environmental conditions cause cells to stick together or to stay together when they divide, to lead to the evolution of multicellularity. And the thought is that somehow, in some mysterious way, the effect that the environment has on forcing these cells to stick together and be multicellular could be taken over by the DNA, so that the DNA could encode instructions for staying together or coming together and being a multicellular aggregate. Because the evolution of multicellularity in labs has been achieved not by directly changing the DNA, but by imposing environmental conditions that favor the evolution of multicellularity. Now, of course, the DNA of these organisms changes in response to those environmental changes, but precisely how those changes in the DNA could become totally independent of the environment, so that you would have a self-sustaining developmental genetic program encoded by the DNA of just one cell that would make sure that a multicellular organism arose that could reproduce as a multicellular unit, that's still a big mystery. That's something that I would love to be able to understand.
Well, this is definitely a fascinating question, or sort of series of questions looking into, I guess, the origins of complex life and how it evolved. And I think this is really a fascinating area of study. So great food for thought for myself and our listeners. Now, we've had some excellent conversations today, Cassandra. Can we end our talk today with just one last piece of advice, or one last piece of inspiration for all of our listeners out there?
The best piece of advice that I was ever given was given to me by my father. And he would give this to me many times over the course of my childhood. He would say, don't let anybody push you around. Sometimes he would even use that as a salutation when I was leaving the house. Instead of saying, bye, have a good day, he would say, don't let anybody push you around.
Oh, wow. I love that.
And that's been really important for me over the course of my life. And so whether you're a scientist or whether you're not, you have to figure out what it is you enjoy doing and what your goals are. In some sense, whether they're short-term goals or long-term goals, it doesn't matter. And in all of this figuring out process, you're always going to have a lot of external input. And that can be fine, because it's difficult for us to know everything by ourselves. We can't do that. And other people's perspectives can be really helpful and influential in positive ways. But other people always also have their own agenda. At the end of the day, there's almost nobody in the world who's more interested in somebody else than they are interested in themselves. And so everyone's advice to you and recommendation to you is going to, through no fault of their own, only be a reflection of their own agenda and their own perspectives and their own experiences. And so it's really important to learn to sort out what you want from what other people want, and try your best to stay focused on what you want. And if that's compatible with what other people want, well, that's fantastic. Life will be a lot easier for you. But it won't be compatible with what other people want all the time. And it's important to stay strong and stay true to yourself in those moments.
Very, very well said, Cassandra. I think that is fantastic advice for our listeners, and particularly anyone out there who might be a young scientist just starting on this journey and really being intimidated by the whole process. Just know, don't let anyone push you around.
Mm-hmm.
So wonderful advice, Cassandra. Now, can you tell our listeners how they can reach out to learn more about your research?
Sure. The best way to contact me is by email, and you can find my email on my lab website, which is www.extavourlab.com. So that's www.extavourlab.com. My email address is on there, and anyone can feel free to contact me.
Wonderful. Well, we appreciate that. And Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing so many of your wonderful experiences and insights.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, it was a delight to chat with you. And thank you to our listeners out there. Join us again next time for another episode of People Behind the Science. Your voyage to the lives of today's exceptional scientists has just begun. You can find everything we talked about today, including our guests' favorite books, biographies, photos, and more, when you visit us at www.peoplebehindthescience.com. I look forward to seeing you next time on People Behind the Science.